Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Friday, March 5th, 2021. Section A. City County to receive combined $58.5 million from Relief Bill by Caitlin Randall, CRANDLE at MRT.com. The City of Midland will receive $24.2 million and Midland County will receive $34.3 million if the U.S. Senate passes the American Rescue Plan Act. The House passed the $1.9 trillion coronavirus aid and stimulus package on February 27th, and the Senate began debating the plan this week. The state of Texas will receive $16.8 billion if the Senate approves the bill. The city of Midland previously received $37.3 million from CARES Act funding and other coronavirus-related grants, according to a city spokesperson. Midland International Airport received $23 million of those funds as part of $10 billion in economic relief that was awarded to U.S. airports, according to a previous Reporter Telegram article. Midland City Council members used the remaining funds to establish a small business grant program and assistance program for renters and landlords. They also allotted money to the Midland County Hospital District for an additional testing site, any antibody center and equipment, Midland ISD for remote learning equipment, Casa de Amigos for its rent and utility assistance program, reimbursing the city for COVID-19 related expenses, the West Texas Food Bank, Midland Health for extended testing site hours, St. Anne's Church for its rent and utility assistance program, St. Vincent de Paul Society for its rent and utility assistance program, the Boys and Girls Club of Midland for additional staffing, and the purchasing of equipment and supplies related to the pandemic. Midland County previously received $1.7 million in CARES funding, according to state records. County Judge Terry Johnson said most of that funding was used on supplies, including emergency generators, personal protective equipment, and mobile tents. Ector County is set to receive $32.2 million from the stimulus package, and the city of Odessa will receive $21.8 million if the bill passes. The Senate is expected to vote on the American Rescue Plan Act this weekend. Energy. Report. Gas price has increased by 26 cents in the last 2 weeks. By Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N at HurstNP.com. The average price of gas in Midland has increased by 26 cents in the last 2 weeks, according to AAA Texas. The organization reported Thursday that the average increased by 14 cents this week in Midland, more than any other metropolitan area in the state except El Paso. The increase in Midland also was twice the average across the state. AAA Texas also reported that virtually all West Texas communities were impacted by spiking prices this week. Prices in Midland, Amarillo, Abilene, El Paso, Odessa, San Angelo, and Wichita Falls all jumped by 10 cents or more. West Texas communities made up 63.6% of the larger communities across the state, where prices increased by 10 cents or more. Distributors have told the Reporter Telegram there are many complexities in the fuel business that impact pricing. They pointed to the high cost of transportation from Gulf Coast refineries and Midland's distance from pipelines. Midland's average price rose to $2.68, which is 1 cent lower than the average in Odessa. The highest average in the state is $2.73 in El Paso. Abilene is fourth with an average of $2.55. AAA Texas reported this week that drivers in Texas are seeing the most expensive statewide pump price average since August 2019, and that motorists can expect continued increases of at least 5 to 10 cents in local markets until refinery operations are stable. The latest Energy Information Administration report shows demand for retail fuel rose to 8 million barrels per day across the U.S. March could bring the highest pump prices this year, barring any issues again during hurricane season. Since January 1st, the average price in Midland is up 61 cents. The state average has increased 53 cents. As virus-era attacks on Asians rise, Midland victims look back. By Terry Tang. Nearly a year after they were almost stabbed to death inside of Midland's Sam's Club, Bawi Kung and his two sons all have visible scars. It's the unseen ones, though, that are harder to get over. Kung can't walk through any store without constantly looking in all directions. His six-year-old son, who now can't move one eyebrow, is afraid to sleep alone. On a Saturday evening in March, when COVID-19 panic shopping gripped the nation, Kung was in search of rice at a cheaper price. The family was in Sam's Club meat section when Kung suddenly felt a punch in the back of his head. A man he didn't know then slashed his face with a knife. The assailant left, but soon returned to stab the boys. He wounded the 3-year-old in the back and slashed the 8-year-old from his right eye to a couple of inches past his right ear. The grisly encounter brought home the dangerous climate Asian Americans have faced in the coronavirus in the U.S., with racially motivated harassment and assaults occurring from coast to coast. Now, just over a year and thousands of incidents later, some of the early victims find moving forward has been difficult, or at best, bittersweet. A recent wave of attacks on elderly Asian Americans, including the death of an 84-year-old San Francisco man, has fueled worries that hostilities have only worsened. In Kung's case, the man responsible for the attack believed the Myanmar man and his children were Chinese and spreading the virus. Kung said he's not sure what would have happened had a Sam's Club employee, Zach Owen, not intervened. Maybe I might kill him. Maybe he might kill all of my family. I don't know. God protected my family. God sent Zach to protect my family right there at the right time. Owen, who was stabbed in the leg and deeply cut in his right palm, and an off-duty Border Patrol agent detained the suspect, Jose Gomez, 19 years old. Verbal attacks have also made a lasting mark. In April, a confrontation in a Richmond, California park left an irrevocable impact not just on Kelly Yang, 36, but her children. She was forced to discuss anti-Asian racism with her son, 10, and daughter, 7, a talk she didn't think would happen for a few more years. An elderly white couple, upset over her unleashed dog called Yang, who is Chinese-American, an Oriental, and said the words many Asian Americans dread, "Go back where you came from." Her children thought the couple meant for them to go home. Torn, Yang eventually explained they meant for us to go back to Asia. "It means that we're not welcome here." Her son burst into tears. Yang believes the couple felt emboldened by then-President Donald Trump's use of racially charged terms like Chinese virus. She applauded President Joe Biden's recent executive order condemning anti-Asian xenophobia as a good start, but she is afraid a lot of non-Asians have already shrugged off the issue as though it ceased when Trump's presidency did. "I don't know what can be done," said Yang, who writes young adult novels and plans to weave her experience into her next book. "But I do know talking about it, acknowledging it, remembering, that's what we do with wars. We have to remember what happened." Douglas Kim, 42, chef and owner of Jeju Noodle Bar in New York City, is certain COVID-19-fueled racism was behind the April vandalizing of his Michelin-starred Korean restaurant. Someone used a Sharpie to scrawl on the winter vestibule, stop eating dogs, referring to a stereotype about Asian cuisines. Ultimately, Kim decided not to report it. At the time, it pissed me off, but I have more important things to worry about, Kim said. Maintaining a business is more important. He shared a picture of the graffiti on Instagram to call attention to hate crimes. There was a groundswell of support, but he feels like much of it has faded. Yet, Kim is hopeful few people are stereotyping Asian Americans as foreigners who don't belong in the U.S. I think it's all about education, Kim said. If you raise your children that way, they're going to learn that way. I think things are changing, but it's not 100% yet. That's why somebody who obviously wrote that on our door. More than 3,000 incidents have been reported to Stop AAPI Hate, a California-based reporting center for Asian American Pacific Islanders, and its partner advocacy groups since mid-March 2020. What's frustrating is that the encounters don't often rise to the legal definition of a hate crime. Still, police in several major cities saw a sharp uptick in Asian-targeted hate crimes between 2019 and 2020, according to data collected by the center. New York City went from three incidents to 27. Los Angeles from 7 to 15, and Denver had three incidents in 2020. The first reported there in 6 years. A rash of crimes victimizing elderly Asian Americans in the past 2 months has renewed outcry for more attention from politicians and the media. On Wednesday, California Governor Gary Newsom signed off on legislation allocating a $1.4 million to Stop AAPI Hate and the UCLA Asian American Studies Center. The funding will go toward community resources and further tracking of anti-Asian hate incidents. Local officials and citizens have also taken notice. Initiatives like increased police presence, volunteer patrols, and special crime hotlines are coming to fruition. Big-name brands like the Golden State Warriors and Apple, based in the Bay Area, have promised to donate to the cause. Cynthia Choi of Stop AAPI Hate wishes news cycles would focus not just on the latest crimes, but the solutions being discussed. Policing and prosecution aren't necessarily the answer, she said. COVID-19 vitriol is rooted in more than a century of anti-Chinese and anti-immigrant attitudes. She and other advocates think more investment in education and community resources could help get those root causes. Anti-Asian xenophobia should be part of the ongoing conversations on racial reckoning. Our work to address anti-Asian racism is inextricably tied to fighting anti-Black racism, Choi said. That's going to take all of us. It's going to take public education efforts. It's going to take racial solidarity efforts that really bring our communities together. Before immigrating to the U.S. 6 years ago, Kung, the Texas hate crime survivor, had never encountered racism. Now it's difficult for him to hear stories about anti-Asian American violence. Initially, after the attack, Kung wrestled with how Gomez tried to kill him simply because of how he looked. Now he prays for his attacker. As for what should happen to Gomez, who remains jailed on 3 counts of attempted capital murder, Kung says that's up to the courts. I can forgive him, but we cannot accept racism or that kind of terrorist attack, said Kung, who received more than $20,000 in online donations. One thing he is looking ahead to, life as a newly naturalized U.S. citizen in a country where they respect people. Kung remains unbothered that he may not fit some people's idea of what America looks like. Maybe personally they have racism, Kung said. I don't care. I'm proud of being Asian and Asian American. Obituaries and death notices. Frances Marion Hewling Dixon passed away on March 2nd in Midland. A memorial service will be held at First Baptist Church in Midland at 12:30 on Saturday, March 6th. In lieu of flowers, please donate to your favorite charity. J. Roger Ridgway passed away Monday, February 22nd, at the age of 86. A memorial service will be held 10 a.m. Saturday, March 6th, at the Main Church of Christ in Big Spring, Texas. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklum Welsh Funeral Home and Crematory. Janice Lord Aldridge, 68, of Midland, entered the heavenly gates on February 28th in the presence of her loving husband of 49 years and both her daughters. Visitation will be held on Thursday, March 4th at Ellis Funeral Home. Graveside services at Rest Haven Cemetery will be held on Friday, March 5th at 1 p.m. Ruth Worthy passed away on February 15th in Midland. Memorial services will be held at Valley View Baptist Church on Saturday, March 6th, 11 o'clock a.m. Colton Ross Huckabee, 27, of Andrews, passed away February 28th. The family will receive guests from 6 to 8 p.m. Monday, March 8th at Nellie Picklum Welsh Funeral Home. Graveside services will be held at 1 p.m. Tuesday, March 9th at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Laura Payne of Midland passed away January 25th. Memorial service will be held at 5 p.m. Monday, March 15th at Nellie Picklum Welsh Funeral Home. Richard James Anthony of Midland passed away Tuesday, March 2nd. A memorial service will be held at a later date. MDC authorizes plan to sell 53 acres in David Mims Business Park by Mella McEwen. MMCEWEN at MRT.com. Members of the board of the Midland Development Corp on Thursday gave Chairman Wesley Bounds authority to negotiate a purchase and sale agreement on 53.6 acres tract in the David Mims Business Park on Interstate 20. Sarah Harris, MDC Director of Operations and Chief Financial Officer, told the Reporter-Telegram there are some parties interested in the tract, but any sale is early in the negotiation stage. She added that MDC, which has owned the 73-acre tract since 2006, had sold 20 acres to Weir Oil and Gas in 2017 for a service center. That, she said, added $30 million to the tax base. MDC's goal is to expand the tax base. The tract of land is out of Section 11, Block 40, T2S, TMP R&R Company Survey, Midland County. Foreign nationals provide Texas addresses to get COVID vaccines, from staff reports. Midland Health is considering alternatives to the current registration system that will make it more difficult for foreign nationals to come to Midland for COVID-19 shots. Midland Health stated Thursday they are aware of foreign nationals coming into Midland and providing Texas addresses when they registered for vaccines. The small number of individuals involved provided Texas addresses when they registered, and we have limited ability to challenge such presentations, according to a statement from Midland Health. We are currently considering alternatives that could make it harder for foreign nationals to secure vaccines at our sites. State briefs from Wire Reports. Houston. Man dead, bystander's baby hurt in police shooting. A shooting by a police officer in Houston injured a baby boy and killed a man who was driving a car linked to several robberies, authorities said. Officers tried to pull over a black Mercedes about 11:30 p.m. Wednesday because the car had been connected to several aggravated robberies. The driver did not stop, crashed, and then ran to a gas station where a woman was outside her vehicle pumping gas. The man jumped into the woman's vehicle, and a responding officer saw that he had a gun. The officer opened fire, killing the man, but also striking a one-year-old boy who was in the back seat. The officer did not know the boy was in the vehicle. Pray for this one-year-old and his mother. Can you imagine pumping gas and having to go through this? Police said early Thursday that the baby was critically injured, but that by mid-morning his condition had improved to stable. The officer who opened fire will be paid on administrative leave pending an investigation. The name of the man who was killed was not immediately released, but Finner said he was about 30 years old. Austin. 315 COVID-19 deaths reported as toll nears 44,000. Texas reported 315 more deaths Thursday from the new coronavirus causes, as the state pandemic totaled near 44,000. The Texas Department of State Health Services said the state's COVID-19 death toll stood at 43,878. The state's confirmed and probable cases rose by 5,900. An estimated 152,267 of those cases were active Thursday, officials said. Opinion extra. Midland Health vaccination process is ridiculously easy. By Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N, at MRT.com. I got my first dose of vaccine on Thursday, and I am happy to report the experience was an easy one. I mean, ridiculously easy. I set up my appointment online and then did my paperwork online the night before my appointment. I am, by far, the most technologically challenged in the editorial department, and it was a breeze. I actually was able to do it on my phone. But the simplicity was nothing like going to mass vaccination site. Midland Health was on its game. Representatives meet you at the entrance, confirm your appointment, and send you in the right direction. Along the way, people are clearer about the process and where you need to go. I was never standing in one place more than a minute. People offer as much information as you want, are friendly through the check-in process, bring your driver's license for that, and communicate very clearly about the next step in the process. They confirm the second vaccination appointment and then provide a vaccine. There was never a line. There wasn't too much information to confuse you. The process when I arrived at the mass vaccination location actually took less time than the drive to the site. Let me say, it is not my place to tell you about vaccines in general. That is your decision, hopefully in consultation with your doctor or a health expert. I am just providing information about the process that Midland Health has set up for those eligible to receive the vaccination. It is remarkably easy, much easier than waiting in a car line for hours. But for those people who choose that option, they are doing what they believe they have to do or are not wanting to wait for their turn to come up in Midland. I understand. Still, there are other places where the process isn't as easy as what I experienced in Midland. I now understand why someone would drive a distance to get their vaccination in Midland. The Midland Health website showed 52,433 vaccinations had been administered through Wednesday, including more than 5,000 through 3 days this week. It is great to see government working like that, like it is supposed to, for the residents of Midland County and beyond. Lastly, if there are people eligible to receive a vaccine but have been waiting because they are uncertain about how complicated the process is, please take that first step and make the appointment. It is easy. From Midland Health, those eligible to receive the vaccine can self-schedule at midlandhealth.org/schedule-my-vaccine or call 432-221-4VAX. Mother's intuition warns of trouble under her roof. Dear Abby, I suspect that something has been going on with my husband and our daughter-in-law. My husband has become obsessed with her, and they both seem to become nervous when they are around me at the same time. My husband is always checking to see when I'm leaving. My son and daughter-in-law and their three kids live in our duplex, but my son isn't home most of the day. Should I be concerned about what's going on with them? Everything in me is telling me something is not right. Signed, Worried in Wisconsin. Dear Worried, I hope you are wrong, but if everything in you is telling you something is not right, listen to your intuition. Continue monitoring the situation and keep a journal of your observations. If your marital relationship with your husband has changed, it's a red flag. Talk to him about it. It may take the services of a licensed marriage and family therapist to get your marriage back on track. Share the journal with your therapist during some of the sessions or with your attorney if the need arises. Dear Abby, my mom died 5 years ago. I didn't talk to her in the last few months before her death because of the extreme stress she put me under. I finally told my brother it was his turn to deal with her because she had always been sweet to him. I dealt with her issues for 40 years and could no longer continue. Mom was greedy, self-centered, and narcissistic. She caused many issues between my brother and me. My question concerns her ashes. I have them. My brother wanted nothing to do with them, and I don't know how to dispose of them. I have considered spreading them in the mountains since she liked camping and fishing, but I don't know if it is legal. Otherwise, they will sit in my basement forever. Signed, Needs a Solution. Dear Needs, contact the funeral home or crematorium that handled your mother's remains and ask what the rules are in your state about the disposition of ashes. Because rules differ in different states, counties, etc., the people there would be the best position to assist you. Dear Abby, I have a relationship problem I hope you can help me with. I have loved this woman for years. We grew up together. We parted because I had to move away to Japan. Well, a few years ago we met again. We began to communicate, and all my feelings for her rushed back after all these years. I know she doesn't feel the same way about me. How can I let her know how bad it hurts, this unrequited love? Signed, Smitten in the West. Dear Smitten, I don't think that's such a good idea. Knowing this woman doesn't reciprocate your feelings, do you really think informing her that all those feelings have rushed back will endear you? It may cause her embarrassment. You will be happier if you stop dwelling on your unrequited love from the past, resolve to live in the present, and from now on look for companionship from candidates who are emotionally available. Midland College Profiles by Rebecca Bell. Pathway Program helps students to medical school. Three Midland County High School graduates are now one step closer to medical school. Zainab Falana, Enrique Mikey Mangan, and Jonathan Michael, John Michael, Mark Graff have all been accepted to Texas College of Osteopathic Medicine and will either enter medical school in summer of 2022. The students will graduate this coming May from Midland College with an Associate of Science degree through MC's Primary Care Pathway Program. This coming August, they will enter the University of North Texas, UNT, and spend 1 year there taking upper-level science courses before entering TCOM. What all this means is that before obtaining their associate degrees, the three students have been accepted to medical school without having to take the rigorous and expensive MCAT medical school entrance exam. In just 6 to 7 years after high school graduation, they will enter a medical residency program, an accomplishment that normally takes 8 years at a minimum. All three indicated that they want to return to Midland to practice medicine. Zainab said that she knew she wanted to be a physician when she was a sophomore at Midland High. I lost my father when I was in the 10th grade, Falana said. My mom has a friend who is a doctor, and she really helped my family through our grieving process. I had always been good in math and science and thought that I might want to go to medical school. However, the compassion that my mom's friend showed to our family made me realize that I wanted to not only be able to help people through skill, but also have the opportunity to be compassionate to fellow humans. There are 4 children in my family, and I wasn't sure I would be able to attend medical school because of finances. A high school counselor told me about MC's Primary Care Pathway Program, and I was immediately interested. I could stay home for 2 years and obtain great scholarships through Midland College. Falana is the daughter of Falilat Falana and was the 2019 Midland High School valedictorian. Her family moved to Houston from Nigeria when Zainab was 9. Her father's job in the oil and gas industry eventually caused a job transfer to Midland. Zainab's mother works at H&R Block in Midland. Zainab currently works for 20 hours a week as a medical scribe at Midland Memorial Hospital. Ricky Mangan is the son of Yomar and Michael Mangan. Unlike most of the students in the primary care path program who spend 2 years studying in MC, Mickey will have only spent 1 year after high school graduation. He actually received an associate degree from MC in 2020 at the same time that he received his high school diploma from Early College High School at MC. Mickey has spent the 2021 school year taking additional science courses at MC. When I first heard about the Primary Care Pathway program, it sounded too good to be true. I am very grateful for this program. If all goes as planned, I will have a medical degree within 6 years after graduating from high school. Currently, Mickey's goal is to become a diagnostic radiologist, but he said that may change as he encounters his clinicals rotations during medical school. I'm really interested in technology and medicine, he said. Radiology has historically been the leader in applying technological advancements to workflow and patient care. That trend shows no slackening. John Michael Markgraf graduated from Midland Classical Academy in 2019. He said that his parents, Stephanie and Jim Markgraf, instilled in him a sense of service to others. Throughout high school, I volunteered as a tutor to children who were living at Midland Fair Havens. When I was a senior in high school, I took an anatomy and physiology course and really enjoyed it. That's when I decided that becoming a physician will be a good avenue for an enjoyable career where I can help others. Markgraf currently tutors college students who are wanting to get into nursing school. MC Associate Professor of Biology Joseph Schenkman serves as coordinator of the Primary Care Pathway Program. He explained that the purpose of the program is to increase the number of physicians practicing primary care in the Midland area and in the state of Texas. The program contains the following components: an enhanced 3-year pre-med curriculum that includes 2 years at MC and 1 year at UNT, healthcare enrichment activities that include mentoring and physician shadowing, and a summer enrichment experience. So far, 20 program graduates have been accepted into TCOM. To be eligible for MC's Primary Care Pathway program, high school graduates must have competitive college entrance exam scores and be U.S. citizens or permanent residents with Texas residency. Dual credit coursework may be accepted at the discretion of the program committee. Since the Primary Care Pathway program's inception in 2016, participants have completed more than 2,000 community service hours, averaging 100 hours per student, and more than 1,000 health care-related service learning hours. While at MC, the students have also participated in more than 1,500 clinical training hours at Midland Memorial Hospital, averaging 75 hours per student. The average GPA for program participants graduating from MC is 3.8, and the average GPA for program students at UNT is 3.9. Schenkman said that students who successfully complete all the requirements in the prescribed time frame while maintaining at least a 3.5 GPA may be granted an interview that can lead to an offer of early acceptance admission to TCOM. Additionally, by attaining all only A's and B's while maintaining the 3.8 GPA, the submission of an MCAT score will be waived. Falana, Mangan, and Markgraf are three of those students. Schenkman further explained that, in addition to partnering with UNT, the program's success can also be attributed to a third partner, Midland Memorial Hospital. Because of the relentless efforts of our two partners, the Midland community, University of North Texas Health Science Center, and, of course, Midland College faculty, staff, and administration, these students have continued to gain the foundation necessary to continue their success beyond Midland and Midland College. The fact that Zainab, Ricky, and John Michael want to return to Midland to practice medicine and give back to this community says a lot about the support they have received. Midland College has provided these students the tools and support for their success, but it is their drive and motivation toward medicine that makes them truly successful. Focus on education. Highlighting the achievements and progress of MISD. Spirit of service is alive in today's students. Midland ISD graduate finds creative ways to improve his community. One of the most important lessons students learn at MISD is serving their community. One student who took that lesson to heart was 2019 MISD graduate Felix Hinosa. As a senior at LHS, Hinosa was researching ways he could complete his 40 hours of community service for Midland College's Legacy Scholar Program when he realized MISD was on their approved list. At the time, Hinosa was doing landscaping work to save for college expenses. That's when he approached a teacher about his idea. Use his community service hours and experience to beautify the campus around him. He would volunteer his time and energy to help his coaches with the time-consuming work of setting up and maintaining the baseball fields, and also help with picking up litter around the school. Several of his baseball teammates joined in, and they quickly had a group of four or five spending their evenings after practice weeding and mowing, manning concession stands during JV games, and taking pride in their school grounds. Hinosa's pride in his campus extended beyond graduation. Legacy Scholar Program students are required to continue volunteering each year they're in the program. Hinosa chose to continue volunteering at LHS to help his former coaches and teammates. Along with preparing students for college and career, MISD also aims to prepare students to be active members in the community, whether in leadership roles or simply volunteering their time. Small acts of kindness can change lives, and MISD strives to instill a community-minded spirit in students from the first day they enter our hallways, said Elena Ladd, Chief Communications Officer for MISD. It's wonderful to see how that passion for giving back can continue well after graduation. Hinosa credits his parents with instilling a strong drive to volunteer and give back to his community. They taught me that you don't always have to make money to be satisfied in what you're doing, he said. Knowing that you're helping people is what is satisfying. UT Austin won't require SAT or ACT scores for the 2022 applications. By Kate McGee, Texas Tribune. The University of Texas at Austin is suspending the SAT and ACT test scores requirement for fall 2022 applicants, citing continued limited access to testing opportunities for students due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The continuation of the temporary suspension will ensure that testing limitations related to COVID-19 do not affect a student's ability to apply to be considered for admission to UT Austin, the university said in a statement. The flagship university is the latest among schools across the country to extend the temporary hold on the traditional application requirement. Earlier this year, multiple Ivy League universities and others had extended their test optional policies through 2022. In Texas, Rice University in Houston made the similar announcement. The University of Houston system also said it would remain test optional through fall 2022 and would consider making the change permanent. Baylor University also made the standardized tests optional through fall 2023 and said it will reevaluate the policy for future years. Texas A&M University also has extended its policy to 2022 applicants and anticipates 2023 will be test optional as well. Last year, multiple Texas universities temporarily scrapped the testing requirement for 2021 applicants as the College Board canceled test exams and large exam sites were closed, including Texas A&M University, Texas Tech, Texas Christian, and Southern Methodist. SMU also announced Thursday that they would remain test optional for fall 2022 and spring 2023 admissions.
This article is entitled API Mull's Embrace of Carbon Pricing by Jennifer A. DeLuey, Bloomberg. The American Petroleum Institute is considering throwing its weight behind a government-imposed price on carbon dioxide emissions as a way to show global warming, a major policy shift by the oil industry's top trade group. API's draft policy statement does not endorse a specific mechanism, such as a tax on carbon dioxide emissions or a cap-and-trade system, but endorses what it calls a market-based, economy-wide policy, according to two people familiar with the discussions. It could receive a vote by the group's executive board later this week. Proponents argue that a carbon tax that increases the cost of energy derived from oil, natural gas, and coal could be more effective than regulations at pairing U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. Such a tax, the proceeds of which could be rebated to consumers, would discourage the use of fossil fuels while encouraging the market to develop low-carbon alternatives. The Chamber of Commerce embraced market-based policies to limit emissions in January, and several of API's largest members, including ExxonMobil Group, ConocoPhillips, BP PLC, and Royal Dutch Shell PLC, already support a carbon tax and rebate program. Getting a market price on carbon is going to be really important to make sure that we're using market forces to try most cost-effectively to reduce CO2 emissions, Exxon's Chief Executive Officer, ExxonMobil Chief Executive Officer Darren Woods said at the CERA Week by IHS Market Conference Tuesday. Governments should not pick winners and losers. The efforts have gained momentum as international energy companies are making investment decisions based on the assumption that emission limits will be imposed by regulation, tax, or other mechanisms. The companies are seeking regulatory certainty on the issue instead of environmental policies that whipsaw with every presidential election. And they are bracing for possible tariffs on imports from countries with lax climate policies, a potential risk for U.S. companies selling carbon-intensive products globally. API previously telegraphed its support in January when it said it supported the ambitions of the Paris Agreement to pair greenhouse gas emissions and cited, quote, market-based policies, unquote, such as carbon pricing, as a way to balance those reductions with flexibility and pacing to keep energy affordable. API Senior Vice President of Communications Megan Blumgren said the group has convened top energy officials throughout the supply chain to incubate a host of policy solutions and industry actions to shape a lower carbon future. Our efforts are focused on supporting a new U.S. contribution to the Global Paris Agreement, Blumgren said by email. Consideration of API's move was earlier reported by the Wall Street Journal. Some environmentalists who oppose fossil fuel development criticized the possible move, with Maya Golden-Krasner, Deputy Director of the Center for Biological Diversity's Climate Law Institute, calling it, quote, little more than a public relations ploy, unquote. Instead of letting producers buy their way out of climate accountability, we need strong regulations to keep fossil fuels in the ground, Golden-Krasner said. The effort divides the oil and gas industry. Some large integrated energy companies that have global operations and investments in low-carbon businesses favor the approach. Many independent oil producers and refiners are opposed. Natural gas. A carbon tax could benefit producers of natural gas over coal and spur investment in renewables and nuclear power. Several utilities have lobbied Biden administration officials to support a nationwide carbon price. And Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, who previously endorsed a carbon tax as the textbook solution to climate change, reiterated in January that effective carbon pricing is essential to solve the climate crisis. I am fully supportive of effective carbon pricing, and I know that the president is as well, Yellen said in written answers to Senate Finance Committee questions. Nevertheless, the politics of the issue are challenging, particularly in the Senate, which voted 50-50 along party lines last month to block a measure that would have opposed a carbon tax. Senator Joe Manchin, whose role representing coal-rich West Virginia and heading the Chamber's Energy Committee makes him a key Democratic vote on such issues, signaled his openness to carbon pricing by voting with his party on the measure. Several Republicans, including Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Mitt Romney of Utah, have said they are open to a carbon tax. But developing a consensus plan has proved difficult, with an array of proposals advanced on Capitol Hill in recent years. Some initiatives have lured Republican and business support by imposing a carbon tax in exchange for wiping away federal regulation of carbon dioxide emissions, a trade-off many environmentalists staunchly oppose. Still, other thorny questions surround how carbon tax revenue would be used, with some proposals calling for the money to be rebated to American taxpayers, and others pushing for proceeds to go to environmental restoration projects and revitalizing coal communities. This article is entitled, India Urges OPEC Plus to Raise Oil Output at This Week's Meeting, by Dina Krenikova and Olga Tanas, Bloomberg. India has reiterated its call to OPEC Plus to increase oil production from April as the alliance meets this week to discuss future steps. Artificial cuts to keep the price going up is not something we support, Tarun Kapoor, secretary at India's Ministry of Petroleum and Natural Gas, told reporters in Moscow on Wednesday at the opening of India's Energy Center. It's not the first time India, one of the biggest buyers of the producer group's crude, has urged the OPEC of exporting petroleum countries and its partners to pump more oil. In January, when Saudi Arabia surprised the market with a voluntary production cut of 1 million barrels a day in February and March, Indian oil and gas minister Dharmendra Pradhan said such policy is contraindication is creating confusion for the consuming countries. Higher crude prices amid the OPEC Plus deal were also harming the global economic recovery, Pradhan said last month. The 23-nation coalition continues to idle just over 7 million barrels of daily output, about 7% of global supply. And on Thursday, we'll decide whether to revive a 500,000-barrel tranche in April. In addition, the Saudis will confirm whether an extra 1 million barrels they've recently taken offline will return as scheduled. Crude prices rallied to pre-pandemic levels at the end of February, buoyed by the rapid drawdown of stockpiles and U.S. production being impacted by severe winter storms. While the market expects that the coalition, led by Saudi Arabia and Russia, will agree to an increase in production, the pace of recovery and output remains unclear. This is the Energy Page. This article is entitled, Oil Settles Below $60 Before Meeting About Supply, by Andres Guerra-Luz, Bloomberg. Oil tumbled below $60 a barrel in New York, with the OPEC Plus alliance said to be set to agree to a production increase later this week. U.S. crude futures fell 0.9% to the lowest in more than a week on Tuesday, while its global counterpart, Brent, hit a two-week low. The widespread view among the producer group is that the market can absorb additional barrels, according to people familiar with the matter. That could put the alliance on track to implement the majority of the 1.5 million barrel a day output hike that's up for debate on Thursday. Oil's underlying market structure also has weakened this week. The backwardation, an indication of tightening supplies, seen in key time spreads, is shrinking. At the same time, some pockets of physical oil market strength appear to be wobbling, with observed flows of North Sea crude grades to Asia dropping in February to the lowest in 4 months. West Texas Intermediate for April delivery fell 89 cents to settle at $59.75 a barrel. While the Saudi surprise cut really kick-started this move higher, the unwinding of that will be more difficult for the market, said Edward Moya, senior market analyst at Oanda Corporation. There is still significant risk for the short-term outlook. Crude has rallied more than 20% since the start of the year, with support from a range of factors, including Saudi Arabia's unilateral output cuts. The rollout of vaccines and an investor change into commodities have also underpinned the gains. Even if OPEC and its allies restore 2.4 million barrels a day of crude output by June, global oil inventories are set to decline each month this year, according to an OPEC Plus panel. India has reiterated a call for the group to increase its production from April. Prices were getting elevated enough that stabilizing the market makes sense, said Bill O'Grady, Executive Vice President at Confluence Investment Management in St. Louis. It is a difference between what was expected and what was hoped. What you expect is that they will raise production. What you hope is that they don't. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its allies must decide how much output is to be restored, with current reductions totaling just over 7 million barrels a day. The group is the largest actor in the oil market, with collective production covering more than 40% of worldwide demand. Saudi Arabia always said that its voluntary supply reduction would only last for 2 months. The kingdom will start to roll back its extra cut as planned in April, but is still discussing internally whether to return all of the barrels in a single month or over a longer period, said people familiar with the deliberations. Meanwhile, oil shipments from OPEC's Persian Gulf producers edged higher last month despite the Saudi cut. Increased shipments from Kuwait and Iraq more than offset lower flows from the UAE and Saudi Arabia, vessel tracking data monitored by Bloomberg show. In the U.S., crude inventories are expected to have declined last week, according to a Bloomberg survey. The industry-funded American Petroleum Institute will report its storage figures later Tuesday, ahead of a U.S. government report on Wednesday. This article is entitled, OPEC Production Plunges in February as Saudis Deliver Extra Oil Cutbacks, by Grant Smith and Julian Lee, Bloomberg. OPEC's crude production plunged last month as Saudi Arabia delivered extra cutbacks intended to clear the remnants of a global supply glut. Output from the group fell by 927 barrels a day, the biggest drop in 8 months, to 24.87 million a day, according to a Bloomberg survey. As promised, the kingdom slashed its production by almost 1 million barrels a day, or about 11%. As promised, the kingdom slashed its production by almost 1 million barrels a day, or about 11%. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its allies have been constricting oil supplies since the pandemic crushed demand almost a year ago. To disperse the lingering stockpile surplus, the Saudis pledged extra reductions during February and March. Their efforts have paid off, reviving oil prices back to pre-crisis levels above $60 a barrel in London. The 23-nation coalition will meet on Thursday to decide whether it can relax some of the measures in April. It's widely expected they'll add 500,000 barrels a day of the 7 million barrels still offline, and that Riyadh will confirm the expiry of its additional million-barrel curb. Russia, which jointly leads the alliance, has signaled it's eager to proceed with a production increase. Saudi Arabia, wary that demand is still fragile and inventory is plentiful, believes the producers should continue to be extremely cautious. Illustrating that sense of vigilance, the kingdom cut output by 970,000 barrels a day in February to 8.15 million a day, according to the survey. It's based on ship tracking data, information from officials, and estimates from consultants, including Rystad Energy AS, JBC Energy, GMBH, Rapidan Energy, and Energy Aspects Limited. Saudi exports. Despite the sharp production cut, OPEC's biggest producer kept exports broadly steady at 6 million barrels a day, tanker tracking data showed. Maintenance work at a domestic refineries allowed the kingdom to keep shipments unchanged, Energy Aspects said. While Riyadh made even bigger sacrifices than required last month, OPEC members who have often lagged behind in their commitment once again strayed. Iraq, which is supposed to be making extra compensatory cuts to atone for earlier overproduction, instead pumped more. Output rose by 40,000 barrels a day to 3.91 million a day, considerably above its mandated limit. As it reels from an economic crisis and reaches out to the International Monetary Fund for aid, Baghdad has put the need for revenues ahead of its obligations to OPEC. Nigeria had shown signs of better discipline at the end of last year, and in recognition, its oil minister, Timipre Silva, was sent to guide other African OPEC members in improving their performance. Yet the country lapsed again in February, boosting output by 130,000 barrels a day to 1.6 million. At the other end of the spectrum is Angola, which has lowered production far more than required by OPEC. Its output dwindled again last month by 80,000 barrels a day to 1.1 million, the lowest in Bloomberg data going back to 2007. Deficient investment has brought about a long-term slump in the oil industry of the country, which once vied with Nigeria as Africa's top producer. Despite government efforts to stimulate activity, just a handful of drilling rigs now work in the deep Atlantic waters that hold the nation's greatest resources.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Tuesday, March 2nd, 2021. The education section. Literary strategists will be integral to program's success. Editor's note. The Reporter Telegram talked with Midland ISD officials, including Superintendent Angelica Ramsey, about the changes coming to the district's elementary school reading program. Over the next few days, we will look at those components that will be part of the program's rebuilding, including literary strategists, the standardized programs, and expectations of the intersessional calendar that the MISD board debated and approved last week. By Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N, at HearstNP.com. MISD will not be using the reading angels to describe the interventionists that are expected to play a key role in the rebuilding of the district's reading program. They will be called literacy strategists, and Midland ISD officials describe the role they will play in supporting teachers, helping students, and guiding a program into new times when the district needs it most. In a January meeting, multiple MISD officials stated that the percentage of students in Midland ISD elementary schools needing reading intervention at the elementary school level was greater than 50%. These comments echoed comments made in December when then-interim Superintendent Ann Dixon stated that 56% of second graders were reading at or beyond grade level. The percentage of eighth graders was 36%. That is just more than one-third reading at or above grade level. It will be these literacy specialists that are expected to go into the classroom, get to know those students in need of help, and work with the teachers to be laser-focused on identifying students that will benefit from further support, including during the much-talked-about intercession periods that are part of a new calendar in the 21-22 school year. Midland ISD Chief of Staff Katie Atkins told the Reporter-Telegram that the district discovered there are currently interventionists on most campuses, including those that are called instructional coaches and reading specialists. She said the new position will be streamlined and that those people currently in those positions may not necessarily fit the qualifications of our literacy strategist position. Right now, the job description is being refined and revised and reviewed, Atkins said, and the description will be published shortly. But what we need to make sure is that those people have, first of all, the requisite skills in order to deliver reading instruction. She said the literacy strategist on a particular campus might have a master's certification or be a legacy reading teacher. But it is important they have been reading teachers and have been successful in doing so because they're going to be tasked with supporting teachers in Tier 1 instruction while also working with small groups during those intervention times. A multifaceted role focused on literacy is another way Atkins described the position. She said they will be trained to know the resources that are part of the district's literacy programs, or what Atkins called the comprehensive literacy framework. She also said they will use that knowledge and the knowledge they will have for supplemental materials to address either decoding or comprehension. Superintendent Angelica Ramsey told the Reporter-Telegram that the programs used around the district will be more consistent from campus to campus than they have been in the past. A high-quality, rigorous program is how Ramsey described it. Ramsey said the district she just left, Pleasant Valley School District in Camarillo, California, the literacy specialists needed to know the instruction materials, how to teach other teachers, and how to facilitate for professional development purposes. That collaboration will be expected to take place in Midland. A good strategist, both said, not only can develop relationships with students, but can use certain demonstrated practices that a teacher can then replicate. The teacher is learning things right there in the classroom and not having to wait to the end of the day, Atkins said. They get that learning and get that support that they need right there, right then.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.